This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's day two on the White Mountain as site preps for the 30-meter telescope is set to get underway. There's been lots of powwowing on both sides as state officials move to close off access and protesters try to make it difficult for construction equipment to be brought up to the summit. HPR's Ryan Finnerty is on the scene and joins us live by on the phone. So, Ryan, what's happening right now?
Hey, Catherine. Right now, as we speak, the demonstrators have convened a group meeting. They had kind of come together earlier this morning, and they actually took a vote on how they wanted to handle certain situations or certain eventualities with law enforcement, and kind of came to a group consensus. They actually took a vote, and then a group of elders, the kupuna who have been here, kind of got together, conferred amongst themselves, and then sent a delegation, if you will, out to talk to some of the law enforcement and the state officials. The terms, if you will, that they agreed on were that they will not allow any National Guard to go up the mountain. That's been a big point of concern today, that the state might use the National Guard in some form, either to deliver construction equipment or to break up the protest. And so they kind of came to a consensus that there would be no National Guard allowed up the mountain. They decided that they would allow maintenance technicians and kind of daily services to go up for the different facilities. That was only going to be allowed if the demonstrators were given access to the summit area for cultural activities. And then their final point was that they would keep a checkpoint that they've established at the bottom of the access road. They would keep that there. And they went and conferred with some representatives of the state and law enforcement. No word on what the decision from that meeting was, but we can assume it didn't go quite as they would have liked because they've reconvened a group meeting. They wouldn't allow anyone in the media in, so we don't know what they're talking about right now. That's happening as we speak.
Yeah, so it almost sounds like they want to keep some of their strategy close to the chest.
I'm sorry, say that again. You cut out, Catherine.
It sounds like they want to keep some of their strategy close to their chest.
Yeah, that's been a big concern of theirs from the get-go. When I got here on Sunday night, I was able to sit in on a meeting. And they made a point of saying that they were going to split up their planning into different groups, that the different groups wouldn't really know specifically what each other was doing other than major objectives, that they're worried about informants or undercover police officers, that kind of thing. And now that seems to have extended to members of the media. It hasn't been unfriendly or anything like that. They kind of politely ask us to move back when they would like us to. We haven't had any difficulty speaking to various members of the movement, including the leadership, but at certain points throughout the day, they do kind of clear us out. An official with the state who's on hand, several of them are walking around, said that that's not technically legal for them to do that since it is public land, but everybody's kind of respecting that for the moment.
So it sounds like a lot of waiting around and no arrests yet.
Yeah, that's right. So yesterday, as you remember, was pretty hectic. There was a lot of activity. The specter of arrest was kind of looming, ever present. Today it's much quieter, as you said. A lot of waiting around, both for us watching it and for a lot of members of the movement who are kind of waiting to see what their leadership decides to do and what the state decides to do. I've been told by a couple of people that they've been told by the state there wouldn't be any sweeps or arrests or anything like that today. But as we saw yesterday, they kind of come to an agreement, and then sometimes things break down a little bit. Yesterday, there was that situation where everybody had kind of agreed to go home for the day. The people who were chained to the cattle guard were cut loose and went back down. The police officers left, and then some state officials came in and installed a gate on the access road, and that kind of reignited tension. So it seems like it's pretty calm. but you never really know when it could change.
So were they able to get access to that grade again or not?
I'm sorry?
Were the protesters able to get access to that grate?
Yeah, so the grate, they had access to it yesterday. That's where those eight people had chained themselves to. After they were cut loose, or they freed themselves, to be more accurate, and went back down, the police have now taken control of that. And so they kind of have a police checkpoint before the grate so that nobody can do that again. The demonstrators have established their own checkpoint a little bit below that. But regarding the grate, I would like to play a little bit of sound. I was able to get up before police blocked off access to the grate yesterday and speak with one of the men who had chained himself to it. His name is Kala'ikeo Kaea. He's from Maui. He's a Native Hawaiian activist. And I kind of got down on the ground with him and asked why he volunteered for the most difficult and potentially the most dangerous job that's out here.
The worst thing about it is that all that's allowed us is to express ourselves in testimonies, court cases, all the various ways in which we have shown overwhelmingly our disapproval and really our rejection of how this mountaintop is being used, and it's totally ignored. And for myself, I've always said, I'm not going to say I'm against telescopes. For me, the main purpose is that it's our people to decide what should happen with that mountain. That's period. Yeah. And for us, that mountain is so important in the meaning of who we are as a people. It is part of our humanity. Like all peoples have sacred places. All peoples have places that they treat as being important. We can no longer tolerate being used, watching our mountain being exploited and desecrated. For whom? Not for us. Not part of our choice. This is something that's imposed on us. And what's most important is our people have never given consent to none of the telescopes. And overwhelmingly, no consent to the TMT specifically. And the only way you can impose that on another people forcefully is to see that other people as subhuman. And that's really what is going on here. We're here to reclaim our humanity.
Is he still up there on the mountain this morning?
I haven't seen him specifically. I'm sure he's around here. I did see a few of the other demonstrators who had chained themselves to the grate. There are not nearly as many people here as there were yesterday. I would say maybe a quarter. Yesterday it was probably close to 300 or more. But there are still, quite a number of people, and you don't always run into everybody. Those folks went through quite a trial physically as well. They got down on that grate around 3 a.m. and didn't get off until 2 p.m. They went through some pretty wild swings in temperature and everything. So I think a lot of them are kind of in recovery mode today. We should say, to be fair, that there was also a pro-TMT demonstration down in Hilo yesterday. I was not able to attend that. But it has been reported on by a few other news outlets. And I can't speak to the composition or how many people were there, but those were supporters of the project who were holding a counter rally, if you will.
Okay, well, I hope you're staying warm.
It's the sun's out right now, so it's actually quite toasty.
Okay. All right, well, you take care and stay safe.
Thanks, Catherine.
We have been talking to HPR's Ryan Finnerty, who is reporting live from Mauna Kea. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa. Olehua. gangwa ua umuloka ulana umau ukaho ulave uhavai.
A little later in the show, we'll meet Daniel Koval, the world record holding freediver based on Hawaii Island. For today's backyard quiz, we're going to explore one of the important tools in his arsenal, the monofin. Now, recreationally, you're probably used to seeing the traditional bifins, those short fins that go on each foot for scuba diving or body surfing or snorkeling. However, a growing number of elite athletes who compete in water sports or deep diving use a monofin, a single fin attached to both of the diver's feet. When in use, the diver kicks in a fluid motion, almost like a dolphin, propelling them with great speed through the water. Some even compare their resulting silhouette to looking like a mermaid or a merman. It takes time, flexibility, and a whole lot of core strength to master the monofin technique. For today's quiz, can you tell us who's credited as the first person to design the world's first monofin? Think you know? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Manoa Valley Theater. The musical comedy, The Rocky Horror Show, tells of a young couple who run into misadventure, including meeting an alien transvestite scientist. Opening Thursday, ManoaValleyTheater.com.
It's been 6 months since Representative Ed Case has been back in our nation's capital. He was home over the 4th of July holiday and reflected on his return to Congress. Case talked with us about where he hopes to make impactful changes when it comes to the environment.
The other committee that I was really, really happy to get onto was natural resources. And when you serve on appropriations, it's what's referred to as an exclusive committee, which means you're not supposed to serve on another committee unless there's a really good reason. I was fortunate to get a waiver to that so that I get to serve on appropriations and natural resources. The natural resources committee is responsible for basically anything having to do with our natural resources, as the name connotes. So we're talking about national parks, national forests, public lands, our oceans. Those are areas that are within that committee's kuleana.
I'm sure you probably get an earful from Suzanne.
Referring to my sister,
yes.
Who's the chair of the Department of Land and Natural Resources. Well, in all honesty, it's fantastic to have her there while I'm on this committee, because my job is to work with the state of Hawaii to start with on trying to achieve the state's priorities and purposes in Washington, D.C. So in the area of natural resources, it's natural for me, so to speak, to work with DLNR. And Governor Ige has been very, very good about saying, hey, just work directly with my cabinet members. Now, it just so happens that particular member is my sister. We grew up exactly the same way on the Big Island. We have the same viewpoint on the environment. We have the same concerns for the environment. And so it is really, really nice to just call her up and say, hey, you know, I've got this issue. What do you think? Or similarly with her. And, you know, what do we do about it at the federal level? So that's been a real joy to do. The area that particularly concerns me on the environment is our oceans. National policy on our environment tends to focus more on our air and on our terrestrial environment. And so we spend a lot of time talking, as we should, on the natural resources about, you know, climate change, about the impacts of climate change on our national parks, national forests, and other parts of our environment. We tend to spend a lot of time talking about how do we protect the environment on land throughout our country, but we don't spend a whole bunch of time on our oceans. And, you know, in all honesty, a lot of folks in Congress, they just don't think about oceans.
Right, you're landlocked.
They're landlocked. They're from Kansas. You know, if they think about oceans, they think more about the Atlantic Ocean. They're not familiar with the Pacific Ocean. So it's really not a champion of the Pacific Ocean, especially the tropical, subtropical Pacific Ocean in Congress. And so I've taken that up. I mean, my goal in the environmental area is to deal with our world's oceans. And that comes from a couple of different areas. You know, one would be the basic natural resources of our oceans, so the fisheries of our oceans. Are they overfished? Are they Are we managing it correctly? Are we coordinating with other countries of the world so that we, you know, save our whales and, you know, save our endangered species in the oceans? Another area that is equally important is pollution. So non-point source pollution, especially from land. So seepage from land into the oceans just destroys oceans. And another area is just basic trash in the oceans.
Right.
So a bunch of stuff being tossed in there, and it's, you know, it's just overwhelming many, many of our oceans right now. And so I'm finding my fellow travelers, so to speak, in Congress to deal with how do we fashion a national oceans policy that will actually effectively manage and protect our oceans for the next generations.
You talked about transparency, the need for transparency, and you also mentioned the fisheries. And I know the Fisheries Council is something that you're concerned about whether we're getting proper accounting about certain funds they may be managing. Any headway on that?
I think there is a lot of headway. First of all, we're talking about the Western Pacific Fisheries Management Council, which is a product of federal law. And what they're supposed to be doing is essentially managing the fisheries in U.S. waters in the Western Pacific, which includes Hawaii. So there's a number of fisheries management councils for U.S. waters throughout our country. We're in the Western Pacific. And so the Western Pacific Management Council, WESPAC for short, has been doing this for many, many decades now. And I believe that they have gotten themselves into really a culture of kind of, you know, insider focus, and certainly a feeling that, you know, the way they do things is the way they should be done and nobody can challenge them. We have been, and this has been going on long before I was reelected to Congress, we have been trying to get them to provide the basic information about where they spend their money. Now, you would think that with the sum total of the, you know, many members of the delegation asking them to produce their information and Freedom of Information Act requests, that we would now know where they are actually contracting, the terms of the contracts, and where they are actually spending their money. And the answer is we don't right now. So certainly with other members, Delegate Sablan from the Northern Marianas, who is very much involved in this issue, and again, the congressional delegation from Hawaii and others, we have had congressional hearings. Certainly, we have made those requests, and there has been a lot more attention from the media to the operations of WESPAC, which I think is a very good thing. We haven't gotten all the information yet, so unfortunately, this is not a simple process. But we are making headway to answer your question.
Okay, so just efforts to try and manage not just the natural resources, but also then what's happening with the funds.
Well, you give WESPAC the responsibility for our federal government to manage the fishery in one of the largest swaths of the ocean in the entire world. You want to know what they're doing and how they're doing it. I certainly do. I'm responsible for it. I'm funding them to do that. I'm supposed to be overseeing them. And if I don't have the basic information to oversee them, I'm not doing my job. We've talked a lot about a couple of issues that have to do with national policy, which is one part of my job, is trying to provide national leadership on national issues, whether it be the Indo-Pacific region, or we talked about the military, talked a little bit about the environment. We've talked about some of the Hawaii-specific projects that I've got going, whether it be the, Pearl Harbor or funding through the Appropriations Committee in several other areas, whether they be veterans or the Department of Commerce or law enforcement or social services, a whole range of areas that that I think we've had a very, very successful appropriations season for this year so far. The third area, I think, is sometimes overlooked, and that is my obligation to help people with their individual issues. So we call that casework. And these issues can be, veterans issues. They can be issues having to do with immigration, Social Security, disability benefits. We have had issues with, I just was in my office this morning, and we had issues, dealing with a moving company that went upside down and never paid took somebody's money and never did any services. So what do we do about that for them? Pretty much anything that people can think about, we will try to help them with those individual issues. So that's really important from my perspective, because I can sit here and, talk all day long, as I already have,
right,
about national and helping Hawaii. But at the end of the day, it is the 700,000 people that I directly represent in Congress and indirectly the entire state of Hawaii. I don't think, the congressional delegation has never kind of stood on where the district boundary lines are. We all consider that we, so in that sense, we certainly want to let people know that we're here to help them.
You think we're ever going to get the Filipino veterans the opportunity to move their family members up on that list? I mean, I know
we've had
a lot
some temporary
over
the 15 years or so that we've been pursuing this. We've had some temporary success, but it's not a permanently authorized situation. So, I don't think I feel one way or the other on that. I mean, I'm certainly pursuing it along with the rest of the delegation. We just have to keep pushing. You know, sometimes it's funny. In Congress, like in lots of other things in life, you know, if you just persevere and keep on pushing on things, all of a sudden, someday, sometimes surprisingly, the stars just align.
Right, the and log
all of a sudden,
jam.
And all of a sudden, there's an
free
opportunity to get it. But if you don't push to start with, you never are able to seize those opportunities. So we're always looking for a way to, you know, get provisions like that into a bigger bill or to persuade somebody in the administration that's a better way of,
right.
You know,
I think it's
it.
A concern that the president might end that whole chain migration thing, and particularly for those veterans who have been waiting for, you know, one, recognition, and two, what they were promised.
Well, that's a very good example of why, some of these issues need to be thought through a little bit further, like immigration. We've had family reunification as a key part of our immigration for centuries. And I think that's been positive. If we simply downplay that and say that has no role in our immigration anymore, as some folks in the administration believe, what are the implications of that? I don't think they're positive.
Yeah.
So lots to do.
That was Representative Ed Case, who was in town over the 4th of July holiday, talking about his first 6 months back working in Washington, D.C.
This is DJ Mermaid, co-host of Bridging the Gap. Join me Wednesday, July 17th, for a talk story with one of my favorite music groups, the Hawaiian Style Band. We'll learn about how the band came to be, explore their creative process, and maybe even hear them play a few of their iconic songs in HPR's Atherton studio. Space is limited. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio. When housing prices rise, politicians often reach for a crowd-pleasing solution, rent control.
It provides insurance against getting priced out of your neighborhood.
But what do economists think of rent control?
It's not particularly fair. It's not a good way of helping the downtrodden.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
This evening at 7, right after Counterspin.
Setting the record straight at the City Ethics Commission. That's the subject of today's reality check. Honolulu Civil Beat's Nick Ruby on the line today. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so this is an interesting issue. It's a follow to the story that you've been tracking for months now.
Yeah, well, the Ethics Commission wants to take a look at the recent guilty verdicts against Lewis and Catherine Kealoha. Of course, Lewis is the former Honolulu police chief and Catherine, a high-ranking city prosecutor. And really what I've been hearing from people is that this is sort of a curious thing for the Ethics Commission to do, in large part because the former Ethics Commission executive director Chuck Tato and his former investigator Letha Dakaris had launched an investigation into the Kealohas years before they were indicted in relation to some of the allegations that had been levied against them by the Department of Justice that were at least related to the alleged framing of a family member for the theft of their mailbox. Now, the Ethics Commission under Tato was interested in the use of city resources to sort of carry out this alleged frame job, whether it was installed security cameras at the Kealoha's residence or having dozens of police officers who work in a secret unit tail the suspect in the mailbox theft for days on end. The Ethics Commission director, Chuck Tuttle, of course, believed that that was a potential abuse of power. Now, what happened after that is equally as interesting because Tato, as he was pursuing this investigation, ended up hitting numerous roadblocks along the way from his own commission, which at that time had three new people appointed to it, all of them by Mayor Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell, who, of course, has a fractious relationship with Tato, to say the least.
Yes, and I was surprised to see that they were calling this a special meeting to kind of set out a timeline of what happened.
Right. I think what we're seeing is what some observers think is a possible a chance for them to sort of, quote, set the record straight. In fact, some of the commission staff started putting out phone calls to people in the press, as well as people who know a lot about this case, saying that that was their intention. And I think it was somewhat curious, given that the record is pretty clear in this case and has been for a while. So people are wondering, what is the Ethics Commission really trying to do here? Are they going to come out and say, hey, you know, maybe we messed up in the past and we're sorry about that, but let's move forward? Or are they going to try to sort of defend their actions? And if so, how is that actually going to look in the public?
Yeah, it was funny because I'd put a call out early last week on it, and I didn't get an immediate reply. But then I got the email about this meeting, and I did get a recording on my phone later saying that, oh, we're going to be releasing a chronology of events on Monday. And all day yesterday I was checking, but I didn't see anything.
Well, and there's still nothing posted on their site, at least as of about 20 minutes ago when I checked as well, because I heard that too. And I think really what the Ethics Commission is going to have to do here is they're going to have to document for the public whatever it is this chronology looks like, because, again, there is just a lot of things that happened to the Ethics Commission, whether it was the imposition of very strict rules on Chuck Tato, telling him he couldn't talk to the press or trying to make him track his time in 6-minute intervals, whether it was the Caldwell administration stepping in and fiddling with the Ethics Commission budget or canceling the contract of the or refusing to renew the contract of Letha Dakaris, the main investigator on the Kealoha case, while she was in the middle of investigating it. I think there are a lot of questions that need to be answered, and it's been a couple of years now, and they haven't been able to provide those answers.
Yes, and I know they were hoping that folks would turn out for the meeting to provide testimony, but it's like, well, do people even know that there's a special meeting going on? And, you know, specifically, they're going to be talking about this issue. So thank you for your article.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it is interesting. I know that you mentioned that Chuck Tato plans to be at that meeting.
That's right. The Chuck Tato, when I talked to him the other day, he said that he just wants to be there to make sure that the commissioners don't try to, quote, rewrite history. And I think that is something that he and others are concerned about who have been watching this. Because remember, this is the largest public corruption scandal in Hawaii's history, and it's unfolding in front of us. And you know, there are people involved with some of the spats between Chuck Tato and the Ethics Commission who have received target letters from the Department of Justice, and namely that is Donna Leong, who is the top civil attorney for Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell.
Yes, and I saw that one of the things they have on the agenda is to hire outside counsel, possibly to represent them because of potential conflict of interest. So it's a real mess.
Yes, I think that's an accurate way of describing this entire situation.
Well, I'm jealous. I would love to be there at that meeting tomorrow at 11, but I'm going to be on the air.
Well, stay tuned to Civil Beat. We'll keep you updated.
All right. Thanks so much, Nick.
Thank you.
That was reporter Nick Gruby with today's reality check. To read the latest twist on the Kealoha saga, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, dedicating this message of thanks to all the donors, volunteers, and staff who help to improve the health of those affected by kidney disease. KidneyHI.org.
Governor David Ige recently returned from Washington, D.C. after meeting with officials on a number of issues, including disaster preparedness. This week, we'll be looking at a couple of issues that we as a community need to address before a storm is at our doorstep. We sat down with Mike Mishima, Vice President of Dietrich Insurance, to talk about what homeowners need to have top of mind now.
First of all, you know, you want to have a plan, a safety plan in place for your home or business so that you know what to do when the storm is arriving or where to go if you need to evacuate. But from an insurance side, now that it's the calm before the storm, this is the best time to start taking a look at your insurance policy. Number one, to find out if you have if it's hurricane insurance is included or if you need to purchase it separately.
What's been your experience? What do most homeowners have out there, you think?
Oh, so the standard homeowner's insurance policy will cover a wind event, but once a storm is deemed a hurricane, and the authority to deem it a hurricane is the Central Pacific Hurricane Center, once they call it a hurricane, then you'd need to have hurricane insurance to cover any damage caused by the hurricane.
Okay, so your basic insurance is not enough.
It's not enough.
So if the winds clock 74 miles or higher,
correct,
you're in trouble if you don't have any hurricane insurance.
That's correct. If you don't have the hurricane insurance or even a homeowner's insurance policy for that matter, maybe the only option you have would be to make a claim through FEMA. And then it would be up to FEMA to decide what they're going to do. And that's the part I don't know.
If you don't qualify for help, you might be out of luck.
You might be, exactly. So it would be best, again, at this time, now that it's really calm, there's no storm approaching. In fact, it looks pretty good right now for the next few days, I believe. When I last checked the Central Pacific Hurricane Center website, this is probably a really good time to take a look at your policy. And if you're not sure if you have the coverage or not, then definitely, you know, I would highly recommend talking to an insurance agent or an insurance company representative and ask questions. If you're talking about a separate hurricane insurance policy, typically it's going to be supplemental to your standard homeowner's insurance. So it'll be a separate premium. It may or may not be a separate policy period, but you know, again, the best way to find out is to talk to an agent or company representative.
What about flood insurance?
Flood insurance is typically you can purchase that through the National Flood Insurance Program. Typically, if you live in a flood zone, you definitely want to consider purchasing flood insurance. But I would even say for people that live in a non-flood zone, they may still want to take a look at their area, and if it's a low-lying area, if it's next to a watershed area, take a look at, or consider purchasing flood insurance, because if a loss is caused by a flood, that's not covered by a standard homeowner's insurance policy.
We did see some very freaky weather over the last year, and we saw the waves that were crashing on Kalani Aniole coming from the Mauka side, not from the ocean side.
Right. So in that situation, the people that were in the flood zone, they most likely had flood insurance, but the people that were higher up, you know, Mauka, they probably didn't think about having it. So if they sustained damage from the flood, we'll call it a flood, they probably were not insured for that, and they probably had to pay for the repairs on their own.
Now, I think at the beginning of the year, there was concern about climate change. And I think there was a UN report, and they were saying, are we approaching a time when we might have an uninsurable world? So how does the industry look at this?
As far as climate change, that's an interesting topic to discuss that I think the insurance industry probably is still monitoring the situation. It is probably going to cause a change in how you insure risk. Where is it located? Is it close to the ocean? So I think there's a lot of unknowns right now that will need to be evaluated, you know, for the next several years probably. And I'm sure that will impact, you know, your ability to get flood insurance or afford it, because I believe that if you are in a flood zone, you're probably going to be paying a higher premium than someone that's not in a flood zone.
Is flood zone insurance higher than hurricane insurance generally? Or?
Not too sure, okay. Actually, because I personally don't have flood insurance, but I might be looking into, you know, getting one because of the way the weather is changing so rapidly now, and you just never know.
Right, and we have seen situations where the storm drains are being inundated, where the rate of flow of the rain coming down is just so intense that, you know, we saw what happened on the freeway, right, in off Kalihi, and the motorists were just caught by surprise when they saw that type of flooding. So we're entering a whole new kind of era, I think, where the weather is just becoming more extreme.
Right. For property, though, you would need, again, flood insurance. But for autos, since you mentioned autos, that is covered under standard auto policy.
Flood. Oh, interesting.
So,
okay.
Right. You don't need to purchase separately. But again, for property, whether it's homeowners and commercial property or commercial buildings, you would need to have separate flood insurance to make sure you're covered for that type of loss.
Okay, and then what about as far as your property in your home? What do you need to do to be prepared?
I would highly recommend, and this is probably, you know, advice that can be given at any time, actually, is to photograph, you know, your personal property, especially the high value items like your TV, the flat screen TV, your refrigerator, or any big appliances that have high value. I would highly recommend taking a photo of it. And not only taking a photo of the item, but if you can somehow capture the serial number or you know, the so you can figure out what kind of model it was. So if it becomes damaged, then you have proof of what it was, then it makes it easier to evaluate the value of the claim or the item.
Okay. So pictures more so than, let's say, you know, video with your iPhone or both?
I would say both, because, you know, and nowadays you can store it in the cloud. So because of the technology with the smartphones, you know, and the smartphone photos are very clear now. So, you know, snap away, you know, take as many photos as you can. I would say the best thing is to have before and after photos, right? Because you can see what it looked like before any damage occurred. And of course, you know, unfortunately, if there is damage, then you want to take photos of it after the loss occurred.
Okay, so you want to have that inventory. And then as far as your important documents.
Same thing. I would highly recommend important documents that are either hard to replace or to get a duplicate of. That would be like your social security card, birth certificate, marriage certificate, anything that's hard to replace if it gets lost or damaged. If you can store it in a waterproof container, that's perfect. But if you don't have a waterproof container, a Ziploc bag will do just as fine. Yeah. I just thought about passport too. You don't want to lose that or have it damaged because of a, you know, water, but because you might need that passport as ID, you know. So things like that, I would probably gather it together, you know, have it with you, you know, like, and even have a backpack ready to go if you have to evacuate your home. But it's that famous saying, right, you prepare for the worst, but hope for the best. You know, you're going to be worried enough to take care of your family. You want to make sure everybody's safe, but, you know, so I guess preparation is key. You know, you just have things in place, like I said earlier, that you want to have a plan in place so that you know what to do and where to go if you have to evacuate. Once a watch or warning is issued, typically insurance companies will start issuing what they call moratoriums. And again, once that's issued, you will not be able to purchase insurance or make any changes to your policy.
Okay. Just for an example, like with Barbara, when that fizzled.
So in that, in the Barbara situation, because it was never a threat to Hawaii, I think it was just, you know, people watching how the storm was tracking. But a good example would be last year, Hurricane Lane. Looks like that was heading right to the state, right? I mean, it looked like it was going to hit Oahu, but it made that left turn. In that case, yeah, there was a moratorium was issued once the watch was issued by the Central Pacific Hurricane Center. So you don't want to wait till that point. Then it's too late.
That was Mike Mishima, Vice President of Dietrich Insurance, with a reminder that when it comes to insurance, you can expect a moratorium on policy changes once a hurricane warning or watch is issued. For links to more information, head to our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. Earlier in the show, we introduce you to the monofin, a single fin attached to both feet used by elite athletes who dive and swim competitively. Made of rubber or composite of glass or carbon fiber, monofins vary immensely in style and type according to the needs of the diver. In a controlled water environment like a pool or in the dive line, a monofin offers maximum performance. The whole body is used to emulate the motion of a dolphin, with hands over the head and the kick moving through the core and arms. It takes time, flexibility, and strength training to master the technique. Today's high-tech material has streamlined monofin manufacturing and production, and some say the idea first came about in 1949. Kurt Schaefer, who invented an underwater film camera during wartime service, strapped his swimming fins together, thus designing the world's first monofin. He's credited with designing the first monofin prototype. You can view this artifact at the Aquazoologic Museum in Germany. And that's today's quiz. Oh, I have to say, we do have a winner. Carla McDermott of Hilo. She got the answer right. She says that she has friends with monofins. If you have an idea for a quiz, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Today, a couple of divers who hold U.S. and world records take off to participate in two competitions next month. Daniel Koval and Kristen Kuba live in Kona, and they hold records for deep-sea dives. Koval talked about how he got his start in the sport.
Well, actually, holding your breath isn't as difficult as most people think. I actually teach freediving courses in Oahu and on Big Island. And even in my beginner course, like, I get people, you know, holding their breath on the first day of the course for up to like 3 minutes or even more. So it's just learning about your body a little bit. So we sort of go into the physiology of freediving during that course. And once people realize that this urge to breathe that they're feeling isn't actually meaning that they need to breathe, then they can sort of work past it and hold their breath for longer. So I like to tell people, sort of like lactic acid building up in your muscles when you go out for a jog. You know, just because it's there doesn't mean you have to stop jogging. You know, you can sort of push through the pain. Well, with that urge to breathe, you can do a similar type thing.
Now, you've broken a number of records holding your breath and going deep down. Talk about that.
Yeah, so I think I have 5 records now, 5 United States records, and they've been in a few different disciplines. The first record I broke was with that monofin, which is constant weight with monofin, which is pretty much diving with the same amount of weight as you come up with. So it's all using your own power, and it's my favorite discipline and also the most recognized or deepest discipline in freediving that we have. That's the one that I wanted to do first. And then since the dive is a little bit faster with the monofin because you have so much power with that big dolphin tail-like fin, it started to allow me to get comfortable with the deeper depths, and then I started breaking records in other disciplines as well. Currently 4 disciplines that we recognize in constant weight freediving competitions. There's no fins, which I wasn't born, or I didn't really swim that much in my earlier years, like competitively. So I sort of leave that discipline to more competitive swimmers that have gotten into freediving. But then there's also free immersion, which is pulling down the line, and bifins, which is kicking 2 fins. and then the Monofin. So the other records I set were in free immersion, which is pulling down the line. You're using your arms, so it's a lot smaller of a muscle, so it conserves a little bit more oxygen, but the dives tend to be really long. So even though I'm not going as deep in my free immersion dive, my dive is like 30 seconds longer than my constant weight dive to like the same depth. So and then there's bifins, which is two fins, which I also had a another record in that one.
So did you have like a mentor at all? I mean, if you say you didn't really compete in swimming, or, you know, what got you into the diving part of it?
Yeah, I did have a mentor, actually. So I started out getting into freediving pretty much just like anyone else. Like my dad got me a pole spear for Christmas, and you give a little kid something to shoot things with, go out and do it. So, I got into it through spearfishing, and then, you know, I actually am originally from California. I moved to Hawaii when I was 19, and spearfished in out here. And I realized it's much harder to spearfish out here because you have to dive deeper. So that got me sort of looking into freediving more and how to progress in my depth. And then I sought out some freediving courses. And I actually took a course from Martin Stepanek. He also teaches here on Big Island. And he's actually from the Czech Republic, and he's a 13-time world record holder. And he's the person who trained me, and I took all my courses with, and then became an instructor. So he was actually the first man to dive over 400 feet using the monofin. He does hold courses here on Big Island occasionally. So, you know, if you want to get into freediving, you know, he would be definitely someone to seek out. He mainly does more advanced courses or instructor courses, but I also teach pretty much the same courses, level one through level three, but I do it in Oahu, so it's a little bit more accessible to, you know, Oahu or
okay.
people.
Well, that's good to know. Oh. And then, now, what are the other competitions that you got coming up?
There's two competitions that we'll be competing in there, both Kristen and I, my partner, and it's the Caribbean Cup, and then right after that is the World Championships.
So tell us about her records.
So, yeah, Kristen did a record in bifins last year, 71 meters in bifins. So that was pretty much her first record, and that was really exciting for her. So, and then this year she's even progressed on top of that, so it's going to be really exciting to see her compete at the World Championships because we had some really good breakthroughs with her depth. During the Philippines. So it's going to be an exciting year for us, exciting competition.
Well, that's great. I'm envious of you folks and your skill at going, you know, deep down like that.
Well, I train year-round. Luckily, we have really amazing waters here on the Big Island. It's actually where we live. So right in Kona, we have really deep waters, really close to shore. So we train all the time here, and this helps us prepare for, you know, going to these competitions. But I also do want to say that I was just like anyone else. I didn't really have any natural talent or anything like that. I had a hard time holding my breath just like anyone else, but it's amazing if you, you know, what you will learn in these freediving courses, you know, if you would take your first freediving course, how much you would learn. And then the progression there is endless, as I think anyone can actually really be a deep freediver.
And you can follow the dives with Daniel and Kristen with links to social media on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Colson Whitehead. His new novel, set in the early 60s, is based on the true story of a notorious Florida reform school where many boys were beaten and sexually abused. Dozens of unmarked graves were discovered on the school grounds. The state shut down the school in 2011. The novel's called The Nickel Boys. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3, right after On Point.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we continue our focus on disaster preparedness, sitting down with the gas company, Hawaii Gas, to talk about what to do before the next storm hits. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. Leave your comments at number 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.